This morning, the Southern panel has a series of oral arguments beginning with Valentine versus State, case number 74468. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Your Honor, before I start, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'd like to introduce you to the trial counsel here, the lead trial counsel, Tegan Macken.
Nice to have you with us. Okay, welcome.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Keandre Valentine. We have presented 9 issues for this Court to review, and I'd like to start with Issue 2, which is the challenge to the jury veneer. It's an important issue because it specifically addresses Step 3 in the 3-part test of a challenge. And it is also important because the judge made his decision by relying on an unpublished model decision and ignoring published decisions such as Abzali, Buchanan, Brass, and Morgan that would suggest that when you get to Step 3, if the defense has made a valid challenge on Step 1 and 2, which the Court agreed it had under the issue of Hispanics being underrepresented, then the question is, are they entitled to an evidentiary hearing? And in this case, the Court said no, based on Battle and based on a transcript from another case. And I'll tell you why this decision is wrong. It's wrong because basically what it means is that no defendant can ever make a successful challenge. Because Battle and another transcript suggest that there's nothing else you can do. There's no way you can counter that. So I'm asking the Court to look at this issue under Step 3 and rule that, just as in Azali, where the Court ruled that when you're making a challenge, you're entitled to documentation, but Keandre was entitled to it also. Now, I know that the Battle case suggests, well, grand juries are different because they're secret. Well, that's true in part. We don't know who the grand jurors are, and we do know who the jurors are in the trial, but we don't know the process. That is secret. That is something that the Court has or the jury commissioner has. So we should be entitled to that, and at a minimum, an evidentiary hearing to question the jury commissioner with regard to how this particular veneer was formulated and how, you know, what zip codes, summonses were sent out, and ask any other questions, because the way it stands now, we can never get past you.
Ms. Dickinson, in the request for an evidentiary hearing, it's my understanding that trial counsel requested the hearing for principally two purposes, to obtain testimony from the jury commissioner, but then there is a reference to also submitting Valentine's own expert to testify on these issues. Is it the case that you had an expert prepared to testify on this issue, and if so, was there an offer of proof?
My recollection was we did not have an expert, but that we were going to submit some more points and authorities, and then that never occurred. But the fact that the judge stopped it at Step 3, it doesn't appear to be anything else that we could do because we don't have the documentation that the jury commissioner has. We would need that to go ahead.
Was it subpoenaed?
No, it was not.
The court has heard the issues in other cases, as you've mentioned, and I just continue to be surprised that fundamental processes available to lawyers, like subpoenaing people or documents or records, don't occur. It's just, that's how you try a case. Could you please explain why that process doesn't work in this context?
I think that, in my opinion, the problem is here is that there's no procedures that the jury commissioner or the court has that will allow us just to go in and look at the information. If they could provide us automatically with the information ahead of time, then we would avoid this problem. Rather than requiring us to automatically...
Have they refused to give it to you? Is there a record that you asked for it and they wouldn't provide it? I mean...
Well, we don't know there's a problem until we get in court.
Well, no, but why don't you have the documents in advance of that hearing? I mean, it's not just get the jury commissioner there to ask questions. How do you even know what to ask until you've got the whole... Their processes have to be written down or some information that would assist you in that.
Well, that is a possibility, but still, if we get into court and there's not a discrepancy, then we really don't need to have the documentation.
Why can't you just subpoena the underlying records that form the basis of the jury commissioner's veneer selection process?
Well, that's a possibility. You know, we tried...
A possibility? This is pretty fundamental stuff for trial lawyers to do.
Well, I get
this
that.
This is discovery. I mean...
Discovery from the court. You normally need to discovery of witnesses.
The jury commissioner is essentially a third-party witness, one that can be subpoenaed, one from whom records can be obtained. Is there an obstruction I'm not aware of that allows you access, like any other process, to third-party discovery?
Well, I know that occurred in Avzali. The court would not give us any of the discovery.
Right.
And we had to have a remand back.
Right.
You know, I'm not aware of
it. So wasn't that maybe a clue that...
In Avzali, we went into court and asked the court to give it to us, and that's the same thing we did here. Avzali didn't say that you had to get a subpoena. We went to court, we got the court to look at the issue, and the court said, no, we're not
giving it. I understand your issue on appeal here is that the judge declined the evidentiary hearing.
Right, which would have given us discovery.
But there are a number of issues surrounding, as you raise, battle. I mean, battle's not precedent. Battle raises issues that were years before. I don't even know what factually is correct in the context of battle, and the record wouldn't demonstrate that either. For people to be operating on that as precedential seems rather silly to me. You're here on behalf of a person charged with serious crimes, and you're wanting to demonstrate that this third prong. So I don't know why lawyers don't go get the facts to do it. If you can't, then there are real processes. This just mystifies me.
Well, in this case, it certainly would have done no good because the judge had already prejudged step three before we even got there. So even if we had something, I'm not sure how we could present it.
How is that shown in the record, please?
Because the court said that under step three, battle is the rule. Basically, the court relied on battle and said that the jury commissioner has done nothing incorrectly. So
you're saying that this is more akin to Buchanan? Because the district court prejudged.
Correct. Right.
Like the district court judge in Buchanan.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It's quite embarrassing.
Sorry. But also...
Maybe in the interest of time, Ms. Dickinson, unless my colleagues have other questions, there's a lot of issues here, and I'd like you to talk about counts 4, 5, and 9.
Your Honor, did you want me to go on to hearsay with the grand jury, the statements? Is that what you said? I couldn't hear you.
No, I'm sorry. No, ma'am. I was interested in asking you to address counts, I believe there are 4, 5, and 9, for which you indicated there's no sufficiency of evidence to demonstrate those counts.
On the robbery counts, where the spouse is.
On the robbery counts, right. The way I saw the issue is can the state change the theory of the facts on appeal, and I would suggest they can't. There was no money taken from Deborah. There was no cellular phone taken from Lazaro. And with regard to Juan Torres, he didn't testify. There's no evidence that he even heard a demand to be given money. So they failed to prove this case, those counts, beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to Issue 3, hearsay with the grand jury, Nevada is unique. It is the only state that allows a transcript from the grand jury to be introduced at trial when the witness has testified. Now, there's a problem with that, and that's the problem is in part that normally transcripts are not introduced when a witness testifies. That conflicts with NRS 51.125, recorded recollection. In that instance, if someone forgets something, you can go ahead and inquire and go ahead and ask them to refresh their memory, and you do not introduce the document, not unless you're the adverse party. As I said, Nevada is unique in the hearsay. No one else does it. It sets up an uneven playing field with the witnesses and the questions for the grand jury. It allows the prosecutor to formulate all the questions in advance of theories in the grand jury, of which the defense does not have part of. With regard to many of the other issues, they involve discovery, our request for mistrial, and rebuttal evidence. Here there were numerous discovery violations, and the state admitted did not disclose all of Keanda's jail calls. Withheld DNA charts and graphs, did not reveal that Darnell signed a statement, but it was lost. Super pawn tickets, information was introduced in rebuttal. The state had due diligence to find that and present it in the case in chief. There was problems with getting proposed redactions. The ex-pawn video was missing, we found out during trial. Keanda's jail calls to Janice were introduced in rebuttal without them being given to the defense. And there was an improper rebuttal witness and documents. Luanta, who came in and testified with regard to the super porn tickets. I think to answer these questions, it's a matter of statutory construction. NRS 174.2351 says that the state has to disclose all of a defendant's statements. State disagrees. It's up to this court to look at the statute and see what does it include. But what about missing statements? We have Darnell's missing statement. Well, if it was there and then missing, I think that the statute would require them to reveal that also so that we can cross-examine the witness more thoroughly. The DNA charts, we have a DNA expert who could not make a conclusion, yet she was allowed to testify, and they introduced charts. We objected, we did not get the charts in advance, and the state used the DNA evidence, which was inconclusive, to go ahead and argue in closing that the jury could make up their decision.
You're eating up your rebuttal time.
I know I am. So unless the court has any other questions, I will wait. Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Dickerson. I'm a deputy district attorney with the Clark County District Attorney's Office here representing the state of Nevada. Specifically as to the issues that have been addressed so far, when we're looking at the discovery that's already been mentioned in this case by the appellant, specifically as to the DNA discovery, that had been disclosed. And I just want to make sure that the record is clear on that right off the bat, that what we're looking at is one section of the transcript where specifically 2058, actually, I'm sorry, 2069, line 2. That's the only mention of anything about DNA charts not being seen in this case. The quote is, I haven't seen these other, and then they produced just the charts. Right there in the transcript, they produced the charts. It's very clear. I would also note that none of the motions for mistrial, neither of them, dealt with the DNA in this case. Specifically, too, when we're looking at the other items, the challenge to the jury veneer, as the court has inquired about, this is an issue that defense counsel presented absolutely no evidence at the third prong at all to support anything, any prima facie case.
Well, what about the fact, though, that the court denied them the opportunity to call the jury commissioner, instead relying on a previous transcript in a different case, in a different factual situation, given change in statute, passage of time, and the jury commissioner's declarations at that time that they were going to be changing the system? Why isn't that evidence that they should have been permitted to explore?
Well, the court being aware that the system was changing and that they were actually adding voter rolls would lead the court to believe that it was actually more reliable and less of a situation that would lead to systematic exclusion based upon that.
But how would we know if they did it, if the jury commissioner doesn't come in and testify about what the current practices are?
Well, because first of all, the defense would need to make a prima facie showing to at least establish that. They did nothing here besides give anecdotal evidence and talk about what other attorneys in their office had told them. Specifically,
what about distinguishing Buchanan? what they brought up about, I mean, the judge had already predetermined prong three and just threw in the transcript. How does Buchanan work with that?
I believe that the judge in this case was open to hearing argument, but no sufficient argument and no evidence was presented on prong three for him to even begin to reach a prima facie case. So it wasn't that he prejudged it. He just had done his research and was prepared, but he heard nothing to establish anything that would show a prima facie case of systematic exclusion.
He seemed to place a lot of emphasis on this unpublished battle order.
And other cases that he had reviewed, he indicated. So he didn't just leave it to battle. But battle is persuasive in a situation like this.
But battle, first of all, battle is in 2015. It's an unpublished order. Prior to January 1st, 2016, this court did not permit the citing of unpublished orders, even for persuasive authority.
Right.
So what is anybody doing relying on battle?
Well, he also indicated that he had personally seen the jury commissioner testify about this. He had received.
So is the judge now a witness? I mean, we're trying to determine under the third prong factually whether or not the jury commissioner is how that selection process is taking place in this trial. Statutory changes became effective on July 1st. This trial started on July 24th. Could anybody say for sure that the jury that was picked for this case was picked under statutory provisions that were made 23 days before?
It was the law, and that's what was believed to be relied upon, but there was nothing that was shown by defense counsel to show otherwise.
Nothing in the record to show otherwise.
The burden was upon defense counsel to show that third prong, and that just did not happen. Had that happened, then the judge would have been proper in ordering an evidentiary hearing. But we would be now asking that we just ignore the third prong altogether. If you establish one and two, then you can just get an evidentiary hearing without any other showing. That's what would be established absent actually looking at prong three and asking that defense counsel meet their burden on this and establish a prima facie case of systematic exclusion. Otherwise, we might as well just establish it with prong one and two, and there we go. And we have an evidentiary hearing with nothing further. No other evidence besides a first impression inquiry.
Well, they could have called the jury commissioner and questioned the jury commissioner, and that would have been evidence, facts, the judge could have found, that would have resolved the issue.
The judge had already admitted this transcript.
So the judge put in evidence, but the defense couldn't put in evidence.
The defense could have put in evidence. And I would note that the defense counsel in this case actually made clear that he made this same challenge in his last 15 trials, and yet it didn't come to court with anything to begin to establish prong three. And based upon that, there's just nothing that the court can do other than rely upon what it already has.
Or let them call the jury commissioner. Why does the judge get to pick the jury commissioner's testimony instead of having the jury commissioner, I don't know, go up a few floors, down a few floors, I'm not that familiar with RJC, and take 10 minutes to answer questions? Why is that fair and helpful for truth-seeking when we have that change, that 23 days of should be being done a different way, and we don't know if it is or not? Isn't that the person to ask, the jury commissioner, at the evidentiary hearing?
Sure. Had defense counsel prepared for that and indicated that this is something that they were bringing before the court as evidence, that they had subpoenaed the jury commissioner and that they were ready to challenge this. This is, again, something that defense counsel indicated that they were aware of 15 of their last trials.
But you can't meet prong one or two until you see that veneer.
Well, this challenge was also made off just the jury packet alone without even seeing the veneer. So I would also say that prong two wasn't even met, because when you look at the transcript in Williams that the jury commissioner had testified to in that case, she indicates that the reporting on that of race is not accurate based upon the fact that less than 50% of people are actually answering that question. So without having the jury come in and polling them, you're really failing at prong two as well, so you don't even reach prong three. And so based upon that, it's just not there.
What about the robbery counts on Deborah and Lazaro?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, isn't this really an attempt robbery, and you failed to charge it? You charged robbery?
Under Nevada law, the law presumes that all property acquired after marriage is community property. Here we have testimony that both Lazaro and Deborah are married to the individuals who the property was taken from. We have Deborah being married to Daryl, and he had $100 taken from him in her presence.
What case allows you to do that and charge robbery where no property is taken? Isn't that really an attempt?
Well, the issue is just the possessory interest in the property. And so it would be like if you have a store clerk that is away from the cash register and the robber takes the money out of the cash register, it's not actually taken from their person, it's taken in their presence. Here, it's a similar situation. Just like the store clerk has a possessory interest in the money that's in the till, Deborah has a possessory interest in the $100 that's in her husband's wallet, because it's community property.
How do we know that?
Because that's the presumption under the law, Your Honor, under NRS 123.225. That
how do you know that they don't have a separate maintenance agreement?
There's no evidence of that.
How do you know that's not an inheritance?
There's no evidence of that.
Well, but there's no evidence at all.
Well, the evidence is
that they're married.
Community property is presumed. And so beyond that, looking in towards the property law standards on the family law side, it would need to be established by clear and convincing evidence otherwise. So here, with the jurors hearing that they are married, they can reach, a rational jury can reach that conclusion that, yes, she had a possessory interest in that property, and that property was taken in her presence. As same thing with Lazaro, so the defendant would be guilty of robbery with use of a deadly weapon as to them as well.
I have a question about the grand jury transcripts.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that section 51035-2D seems to say, hey, if they've been questioned at the grand jury and they're present to testify at trial, you can put that transcript in. Does the judge abdicate their gatekeeping function if they're not at least going through the, is it just carte blanche? If they testify there, you can throw the whole transcript in? Does the judge have an obligation to go through that?
Absolutely. It would be like any other piece of evidence. Mm-hmm. That they would have to determine the relevance and the prejudicial value, not outweighing the probative value.
Well, a lot of things come in, too, at a grand jury, such as, grand jurors' questions, which are many times completely irrelevant.
Right.
It appeared that this judge just plopped the whole transcript in without going over what was relevant to the statement and its purpose for admission.
As I recall, the judge did actually read through each statement. I think he took a break and reviewed those to determine whether they were going to be relevant and admissible.
How is the whole statement relevant versus, the whole transcript relevant versus a certain statement? Because what they're arguing is that in Nevada then, anytime you have robbery or any victim of any crime, you get to testify on the stand, and then you also get to put in their transcript at the grand jury. It's almost like double testimony, and the defense doesn't get to put a statement in like that, like, say, recorded.
Well, this would apply equally to the state and defense. It doesn't just apply to the state. As long as they're subject to cross-examination, these transcripts can come in. And you saw in the transcript or in the record here that these witnesses were thoroughly cross-examined on their grand jury testimony and on the transcripts. I think there's going to be situations where the defense, it would be beneficial for them to use this rule and to admit an entire grand jury transcript. Without a doubt.
You also allowed in transcript here, or the judge allowed in transcripts, of the jail calls. Now, how do the jail call transcripts get in? Wouldn't you just be using them as the recording's playing for the jurors to follow along, but how are they supposed to go back behind, for deliberations? How are they admitted? Under what law? Because under my recollection of Bailey, Patano, Ramirez versus State, all of them say the opposite. Whether it's a confession by a defendant, you don't stick the transcription in. You just play the confession.
Right. Well, they'd be an accurate copy of the statement, given that it was an accurate transcription and that's what was testified to.
And you think that that's proper? The transcript goes in.
I do.
Under what case?
I don't have a case site for you, Your Honor, but I would be willing to supplement the record if you'd like. But I do believe that's proper given the fact that this was the testimony. It's an accurate reflection of what's being said, and it would aid and assist the jury in fully understanding the audio because at times that's an issue. And so when you have a professional transcriptionist that is accurately copying these statements, that is something that could aid and assist the jury here. And because it is...
They're transcribed by Metro's transcriptionists. They're not certified.
Well, these are professional transcriptionists nonetheless. And so these are folks that do this on a daily basis and do it accurately. And as long as the record establishes that these are accurate copies, accurate transcripts of what's on the statement, then under the hearsay rule, that this is not hearsay given that it's a statement of a party opponent, and the fact that it is not a best evidence issue, given that it's an accurate copy, then these would be admissible.
Did the parties agree that the transcript was accurate? Was there a determination that the transcripts were in all respects accurate to the tape?
I don't have any information about otherwise, so but I can't speak to that beyond that, Your Honor.
Mr. Dickerson, I'd like to circle back to where you began.
Yes.
Dealing with DNA. Is it the case that the state's expert indicated that the DNA evidence on the handgun was inconclusive?
It absolutely is, Your Honor. It is also the case that the state's expert testified extensively to DNA, how the analysis works, the various thresholds that she looks at in her analysis, and then from there went on to talk about the specific alleles that were located at the various loci on the swab of the handgun. This is...
But notwithstanding the specifics of that testimony, the expert said that the DNA tests were inconclusive with respect to their identification as to Valentine. Isn't that correct?
They're inconclusive as to her comparison and as to her identification of Valentine. That is correct, Your Honor. And as to Issue 9, the closing argument.
This is the third case now that I've seen where a prosecutor in your office has argued to the jury that the DNA outcome, as testified by the expert, is different and should be considered by the jury to be different than the testimony offered by the expert.
With all due respect, Your Honor, that is not what was argued here at all. In fact, what was argued here was appropriate fair comment on evidence that was admitted in...
You are making a comparison that Valentine's alleles fit within the 12 and 13, and therefore they should take a look at this and consider that it demonstrates that Valentine is part of that.
That is not what I said. Looking at the record, it was indicating that Valentine has 12 and 13, and also on the gun was a 12 and 13. And that's misstated in the appellant's brief. I never said that you are seeing this, that 12 and 13, his alleles are on there. I never said that.
And under, this is a quote from 2869 to 70 of the record, as you're winding up this argument, we know one of those had to come under somewhere else. And under Mr. Valentine, we have 13 and 13.2. Ladies and gentlemen, it's just worth considering. Take a look at it. See what you think. You never once in this argument make reference to the fact that your own expert said this evidence is inconclusive.
I did when I first started this argument, Your Honor. Right when I first started this argument and throughout, I discussed the 200 threshold level. We're looking at two different thresholds, right? We're looking at a 40 threshold where there's no alleles found. And nothing about that was admitted. And then we're looking at this other range in the threshold, 40 to 200. Where the testimony came in from my expert regarding alleles that were determined to be found within that range, all that testimony came in without objection. In closing argument, all I did was comment on that, and specifically as to the testimony that expert had proffered without any objection. I never once said that Mr. Valentine's DNA is on this gun. That is not something that I said at all, and that is... In light of the two decisions that you had mentioned, Your Honor, the two orders, that we didn't have the benefit of having at the time of this trial, but in I am prepared to argue that today, even though there has been no supplemental notice filed in the record, but it is distinguishable as to those, given that in Richards, the quote was, that is the defendant. In Sevier, the two quotes that there's an issue with were defendant's DNA was on all three of those items. Defendant's not excluded as a contributor to these DNA samples. This is not what was said here. What was said here is just putting in context what we were actually looking at as far as the DNA evidence. That this isn't a situation where our DNA expert didn't do her job, she didn't establish any alleles, that there are similarities. But in no way am I saying that that's the defendant's DNA. It's just something to take into account. But regardless, this is an issue that can be disposed of with harmless error. Given the wealth of evidence in this case, given that all victims who testified, all seven, identified the defendant in this case as being the robber, given that the defendant...
So do you concede that you erred at least?
No.
You're not conceding that. Your inference is that DNA matches the defendant. Your inference is that the DNA matches the defendant is not unethical.
My inference was not that DNA matches the defendant. And what is still clear in the record, and by the testimony that was proffered by the expert, is that this is still a partial DNA profile. This isn't anything that there could be a inclusion on. So this is just something for the jury to consider as far as what is there.
So you say that's a proper argument?
It's proper argument because it was admitted without objection, and it's in the record.
What if it was objected to?
If it's objected to, I wouldn't have commented on it.
It was objected to. That is, your closing argument was objected to.
The closing argument was objected to, Your Honor. But with that, the comment that I was making on the evidence that had been admitted was not prosecutorial misconduct. The comments were not improper, and the comments were not sufficient to deny the defendant a fair trial. This was not of constitutional dimension, and the error, if any, arguendo, would be harmless, given that all the victims in this case that I previously said identified the defendant as being the robber in this case. The defendant was found in the apartment with the warm vehicle matching the description of the suspect vehicle in the parking lot. He upstairs in the bedroom, feigning sleeping with his flip-flops on, and victim's property strewn throughout the apartment. In addition to that, a gun that exactly matches what two of the victims who knew guns testified to, a Glock being in the apartment, disassembled and hidden in a way that shows that it was in fact hidden. There's, without a doubt, overwhelming evidence in this case that the defendant committed this crime. And because of that, it did not substantially affect or influence the jury's verdict at all.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dickerson. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Justice. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Dickinson, you'll be given two additional minutes for your rebuttal.
Getting back to issue two, the challenge to the jury veneer, it's my understanding what occurred in this case is that when they got to court, they received the documents, and then that's when they made their challenge, because they were on the documents, it indicated racial composition, except for, I believe it was...
Is this in the record?
Yes, they did talk about it in the record. They, the specific document they received?
Yes, ma'am.
That's not, but I can put that in the record if the court wants to see it. I could try to locate it.
No, I want to know what was presented to the judge. Was the documents that you're now telling me about... trial counsel probably engaged in some stuff. Did anybody make a record of it?
My understanding is that when you get into court, it's the court that gives you the documents, and the court has the documents.
But in making arguments to the judge requesting an evidentiary hearing, did counsel say, we have these documents, I want to mark them as exhibits, I want to use them in connection with prong three? This is just fundamental trial stuff, Ms. Dickinson. Did that happen, and is it in the record?
I don't recall that happening, but they did make a record that in the document the court gave them, four people represented that they were other.
Okay, are the documents that you're referring to the documents about individual jurors?
Right, yes. Okay. The jury commission gives them to the court in the morning, and then when you walk in, the court gives you that. And on the documents, these particular documents, it just says the name and
they did
some
the
questions
math
they
about
fill
race,
out.
Correct?
They did the math. And then they asked about four other. Was that particular document entered into evidence? I don't believe it was. They just discussed it, the court and the parties.
But there was no disagreement about the composition based upon the documents that had been presented, correct? The
correct.
Percentage of African Americans, percentage of Hispanics.
Correct. No disagreement. No disagreement at all. In fact, when the court went through step one and step two, on step two we found that we had shown that Hispanics were underrepresented, but not African Americans. And we still didn't know about the other four at that point. So everybody was looking at that particular document. So for step three, then, we needed more information. And that's why they asked for the evidentiary hearing. And in Buchanan and Morgan, both of those trial judges gave an evidentiary hearing so that there was some sort of record. In Afzali, in that case, we had to go back and get the documents, and then we even had an evidentiary hearing with regard to our motions. So in all instances, there was some sort of hearing.
Ms. Dickinson, to Justice Hardesty's point, kind of where we started, in addition, obviously, when you come in, you get the current jury veneer. Mm-hmm. But you have to suspect that there are other documentary evidence in the possession of the jury commissioner or jury commissioner's office that addresses their policies and procedures about how veneers are chosen as a general matter, not as a specific in this case. Wouldn't you suspect that's the case?
I would see that in the, I believe it was the Buchanan case, I did the hearing in that, and the jury commissioner brought the documents to court. And that was the first time I had ever seen the documents. And the documents weren't anything that I recall that the jury commissioner put together, but things with regard to an outside party and documents that talked about how they prepared the computerized veneer list. So, and that was the first time I'd ever seen that. It's my understanding, having been to some seminar several years ago, the jury commissioner was going to start doing a tally or do something so that she would be able to indicate, well, this is how many people identified in this, not veneer, but like the panel or whatever it was. I have not seen that documentation.
But why wouldn't in advance of the hearing there be a subpoena, as my colleague was intimating, that got the documents so that you could cogently question a jury commissioner? Or if the court denied you a proper subpoena on the jury commissioner, you could pursue that denial and try to get those documents in advance of a hearing that you want to happen.
As I said, that is a possibility. That would mean on every case set for trial, that same jury commissioner would be subpoenaed to every courtroom, because we'd have to issue a subpoena routinely without even knowing if we needed the jury commissioner. We could do that. I don't know how many courtrooms the jury commissioner could go to with all the separate documents, but that would, if that's what the court is requiring, then we would do that.
No, but systematic exclusion calls into question how they are choosing jurors in all cases. Mm-hmm. So if you do it once and you're successful, then they're going to change the way they do it. And here the difference is everything should have just changed. Right?
Right.
So this is different
right.
than every other one that happened before. This one should have been different. Right?
Right? You're correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. So we did not know what the jury commission was doing in this instance. I see what you mean. Any other questions?
No. Does anybody have any other questions? All right, thank you, Ms. Dickinson.